Radio Prague News.
The chief state attorney has rejected the justice minister's claim that it is possible to order someone's criminal prosecution. Russian crude oil deliveries to the Czech Republic should be renewed between May the 20th and the 22nd. And unemployment in the country dropped to 2.7% in April. The country's chief state attorney, Pavel Zeman, has ruled out the possibility that in the Czech Republic it is possible to order a criminal prosecution against someone. He said the allegations made by the newly appointed Justice Minister, Maria Benešová, were untrue, saying there were no grounds for such accusations which undermined public trust in the judiciary. Justice Minister Benešová claims the opposite and moreover made the allegations in a report to President Zeman at a time when she was acting as his chief legal advisor. The document has not been made public, but the minister was called on to clarify her claims before the Lower House during the ministerial question and answer session on Thursday. Crude oil deliveries from the Druzhba pipeline are expected to be renewed between May the 20th and 22nd. Pavel Švagr, head of the Administration of State Material Reserves, told Czech television. Imports of Russian crude oil to the Czech Republic and several other EU member states were suspended on April 25th due to a contamination of the oil with high levels of organic chloride. The oil refinery in Litvinov, which is currently processing oil from the country's reserves, will most likely ask the government for another loan. Unemployment in the Czech Republic dropped to 2.7% in April, down from 3% in March, according to data released by the Czech Labour Office. It is the lowest unemployment rate registered since 1997. According to the statistics, 210,000 people are currently out of work. Technically skilled manual workers are the most sought after. The record low figure is ascribed to the healthy state of the Czech economy and the beginning of seasonal work. 27% of Czechs plan to vote in the European elections later this month, according to the results of a survey conducted by the polling agency Stemmark. The agency notes, however, that the actual number of voters tends to be lower than that declared in polls. Of those who have said they will go to the polls, the majority are people with a university education and the inhabitants of big cities. Also, more men plan to cast their vote than women. The last European elections in 2014 had an 18% turnout. Former Social Democrat Party deputy Petr Wolf, who has been on the run since 2013 when he was convicted of subsidy fraud, is hiding in Paraguay, Czech television reported, citing police sources. The police reportedly lost trace of him in Paraguay. Although an international arrest warrant has been issued on him, Wolf has so far avoided detention. The million-crown fine meted out by the court was paid in installments from different destinations, even while the former MP was on the run. Czech scientist Zuzana Musilová from Charles University has attracted international attention with the results of her research indicating that three types of sea fish have colour vision in deep sea environment. Vertebrates were previously thought to have only monochrome vision in the dark. In an article published in Science magazine, the scientist says the special genes that enable this were likely developed to assist species living in greater depth in the search of food and reproduction. And finally, a quick look at the weather forecast. Saturday should be partly cloudy to overcast, with rain around the country and day temperatures between 15 and 19 degrees Celsius. I'm Daniela Lazarová, and that's the end of the news.
Hi there, listener. This is Radio Prague, and I'm Ian Willoughby. Today, EU laser scientists are working on their most powerful beam system yet in a Czech village. It's the 130th anniversary of one of the wonders of the Czech Republic, the country's dense network of marked hiking trails. And later, a new exhibition with an unusual focus. That's how the poorest members of Czech society have lived over the centuries. Well, that's coming up in today's programme. Ever wondered what a 10 billion euro investment can do for a village? Well, Donny Brzezani was lucky enough to find out. It now houses an EU research facility containing some of the world's most powerful lasers. Scientists expect the centre may help in research ranging from star exploration to combating cancer. And they're now working on the centre's most powerful laser yet, as Tom McEncrow reports.
That was not a slap on the table, but the sound of a front-end laser. If you have ever seen the famous destruction of Alderaan in Star Wars, you may remember that the Death Star creates a powerful laser beam made up of several connecting smaller beams. The ELI Beamline's newest laser system works on a similar basic principle. A series of front-end lasers shoot into valves which increase the power of the final shot. ELI stands for Extreme Light Infrastructure, a project initiated by Nobel Prize-winning physicist Gerard Mourou, through which the European Union hopes to cooperate on the investigation of light-matter interactions at the highest intensities and shortest timescales. That means building research centres in the Central and Eastern European member states that will enable groundbreaking research not only in physics, but also in biomedical research and laboratory astrophysics. The most advanced of these research centres is located in Dolní Břežany, a village on the outskirts of Prague. It was built in a joint EU and Czech-funded project worth 10 billion euros. The building houses around 100 Czech and foreign scientists who are currently finalising their L4 laser, which should be capable of firing a 10 petawatt laser beam. A petawatt is 1 billion million watts, and the L4's power burst will be equivalent to being exposed to the sun's rays through a computer screen for a short moment. Czech Radio science reporter Vojtěch Koval explains.
The L4 is built out of two smaller front-end lasers. They built and tested one of them already last autumn. In the past few months, they've been working on the second short-pulse front-end laser, which will then be amplified. Right now, scientists are preparing to further increase the power of the front-end laser, which is now able to shoot a burst equivalent only to 1 kilojoule, the power needed to heat 1 espresso.
Originally, the team in charge of the project planned to dismantle and reassemble parts of the laser in order to understand how the cooling system works. However, team leader Daniel Kramer told Czech Radio that progress on the L4 is going faster than he expected, and scientists can therefore direct their focus on increasing the second front-end laser's power. The most optimistic forecast is that the whole laser system will be ready by the end of the year.
Thank you for that report, Tom McEncrow. The Czech Republic boasts one of the densest and best-maintained systems of hiking routes in the whole of Europe. The very first tourist path opened 130 years ago this Saturday, on May 11, 1889. It led from the village of Štěchovice on the banks of the Vltava River to Svatojanské Prody, and was marked by members of the Czech Tourist Club. Ruth Frankova has more.
The first tourist path in the Czech Republic leading along one of the most beautiful stretches of the Vltava River is no longer in existence, as it was partially flooded by the Štěchovice Reservoir in the 1940s. Since then, however, a whole network of tourist paths covering thousands of kilometres has been developed across the Czech Republic. Pavel Přílepek of the Czech Tourist Club is in charge of the tourist trails marking.
There are currently over 43,000 kilometres of marked hiking trails in the Czech Republic. We also look after cycling paths, which cover over 38,000 kilometres, and we take care of hundreds of kilometres of cross-country ski trails, trails for wheelchair users, and horseback riding trails. I would say around 100 kilometres of new tourist routes are created each year, although some of the unused trails also cease to exist.
Turistických tras nových, nějaké trasy zase každý rok i rušíme.
While the very first tourist path is no longer in existence, people can still hike along the second oldest path. It was created in 1889 and leads from the central Bohemian town of Beroun through the picturesque village of Svatý Jan Podskalo to the castle of Karlštejn. The 20-kilometre path, marked 001, is named after Vojta Náprstek, founder and first chairman of the Czech Tourist Club. The Czech Republic's tourist sign, a bright white square with a horizontal colour band in the middle, is familiar to anybody who spent some time in the Czech countryside. The signs are usually placed on trees or rocks or on special posts of their own, and there is a very strict set of regulations concerning their placement, distance from one another, and so on. They are painted and maintained by members of the Czech Tourist Club, who do it on a voluntary basis in their own free time and free of charge. Pavel Přílepek explains what makes the Czech system so unique.
V jiných zemích, v okolních, jsou ty trasy značeny také velmi dobře.
There are all sorts of systems of marking hiking routes in the neighboring countries, but it's only in the Czech Republic that we have a unified methodology. The regulations have been developed since 1889. At first, only red color was used. As the network got denser, blue color was introduced. And since 1916, we have been using four basic colors: red, blue, yellow, and green.
At the moment, there are some 1,400 people looking after the country's network of hiking trails. Every spring, new volunteers are drafted and trained to do the job. To mark the 130th anniversary of the country's hiking routes, a special march organized by the Czech Tourist Club is scheduled to take place in June along the country's second oldest tourist trail from Beroun to Svatý Jan Podskalo.
That report was by Ruth Frankova. Now, a new exhibition in Prague has a most unusual focus. That's how the poorest members of Czech society have lived over the centuries. And Brian Kennedy has been finding out all about it.
How did homeless people live in Prague during the Austro-Hungarian Empire, in the days of the democratic First Czechoslovak Republic, under communism, and what about today? Two separate yet complementary exhibitions now at the City of Prague Museum take a novel approach to presenting the capital's often forgotten, overlooked, or unknown history of poverty and homelessness.
I like very much that it is paired with a project that is authored by a contemporary young artist.
Tomáš Pospíšil is an art historian and curator of the contemporary exhibit Fire Mountain, the result of a six-year research project by a former graffiti artist known as Epos 257. In solidarity with the Prague homeless community that he documented, Epos 257 prefers to remain anonymous. So Mr. Pospíšil was kind enough to walk me through both the artist's Fire Mountain exhibit and its historical counterpart entitled Poor Prague: People, Places, Institutions from 1781 to 1948.
And it connects together very well, I believe, because poor people lived in Prague not only in history, but it's also something that we have to face today, even that it's not as visible as it might be in the past, but it's here with us.
The historical exhibition begins in 1781. That's the year Emperor Joseph II issued the serfdom patent, an edict which aims to abolish aspects of the traditional system in the Habsburg lands by establishing basic civil liberties for all. It traces the subsequent development of a host of institutions, orphanages, poorhouses, debtors' prisons, mental hospitals, and the like, over the centuries.
It was initiative of Emperor Joseph II, who actually started as a head of the state to build a first policy about poor people. And also it is connected to understanding of human rights, that people do have right to
food, shelter, education, health,
care, all these things that were connected with Joseph II, who we know, I don't know, for example, from film Amadeus as this dumb emperor, but in fact has this very nice side of someone who wanted to reform and modernize Austrian Empire.
So too many notes and too many poor.
Yeah.
The Poor Prague exhibition presents perspectives on the reality of poverty in the Czech capital, mainly in the first half of the 20th century, depicting the survival strategies of the working poor and destitute, as well as now vanished places linked with poverty, such as makeshift colonies of single-room shacks. Tomáš Pospíšil explains.
These colonies on the outskirts of Prague, where poor people lived and that were built by the poor people. Here we have a reconstruction of one of such a house where we can see how spacious or unspacious it was. It's really small, it's really tiny. But for example, even today we can still find some remains of these quarters, these parts of Prague. And some of these houses are still inhabited today. It's in Prague Bohdalec, in Prague 4, Prague 5. Most of it is being demolished, or the authorities are trying to demolish these buildings. But this is something that was taking place for 80 years. It was always like a goal to get rid of this shame of Prague. But it's still part of the organism of the city.
We're in a, I would guess, 2 by 3 meter windowless shack. This would house an entire family?
Yes, 4-person family could live in such a space. And what I like about this this part of the exhibition is the situation today, nowadays, where we can see a new apartment that is being offered by developers today that is a little bit larger, but not much, and costs money that represent, I don't know, 20 years of my salary or something like that. It is an interesting parallel to today. Like today, we don't have the opportunity to build shacks for ourselves, and we all have to greedy developers to build them for us and sell them for this outrageous prices. Mm. As you can see from a floor plan, it's really not much bigger than where we are right now. And quite often, these shacks or houses were built overnight. Which was one of the ways how to fight the authorities. Once it was erected, it was not as easy to make people leave them.
Okay, now this is particularly surprising. Here we have a underground flat in Vysočany from 1926.
It's totally bizarre. There's nothing I can add to this. It almost looked like a bunker or shelter.
Any idea how they came to get these exotic names, Arizona, Mexico?
Well, quite often, like, they could be inspired by popular culture, by Western films.
And one named Eden, or Paradise, I suppose, is a bit ironic.
Not exactly. That was a place of Prague's Luna Park. Different
amusements,
and also with a makeshift colony that was attached to it. And for example, that was a place that was quite frequented by artistic avant-garde in 1920s to explore people's culture, how people entertained themselves. So there were elements of Eden and heaviness in people of workers in the beginning of 20th century. You ask about the names like Arizona or Mexico. It was also connected to the tramp movement of early 20th century. These dwellings should be built by former soldiers from World War I. People that... their romantic dreams were connected with United States and American culture. That's why they named them this way. Bells of world, calling on,
The artist known as Epos 257 studied at the Academy of Art, Architecture and Design in Prague and has long worked on themes related to the urban environment and iconography of the city. His Fire Mountain project stems in part due to his fascination with Prague's periphery, but he has long focused on the life of the homeless, as exhibition curator Tomasz Pospisil explains.
Epos 257 is originally a graffiti writer, someone who's been spending a lot of time in drain yards, abandoned industrial buildings, and was writing graffiti there. And then he noticed that he's not there alone, but this space, these areas are quite often inhabited by homeless people. And he was less and less interested in graffiti and more interested in those people and their destinies. And he's been visiting, documenting this particular community of homeless people that has been called Fire Mountain for more than 6 years. And this exhibition is a result of his research. For the artist, it was very important that his exhibition is paired with the historical exhibition, that it shows that contemporary homeless people are not only a result of post-industrial age, but something that has its history and has only a new specificities in contemporary times. Fire Mountain was well hidden. Like, we will see the situation on the photographs or on the map in the exhibition. But in general, it is possible to say that homeless people are hiding. They are trying to find places where they will be not disturbed. Especially older homeless people live alone. They don't like too much company. So Fire Mountain was a little bit special in this case because it was a larger group of people that was changing a lot during the years of its existence. But it was relatively large.
Are there any of the homeless members of the community who have given interviews to the media, or pretty much everyone wants to be anonymous?
They would like to be anonymous, so as the artist. It's a gesture of solidarity somehow.
Was it in any way difficult to get the museum to host this exhibition? Is it a bit outside of what they normally show here?
It is outside of what they normally do, but there was a big support on directors level, and other people in the museum were very much interested in the exhibition, and they liked the combination with the historical exhibition. But some people in the museum were a little bit confused, like they didn't know why to show this, why to show something that is it's not historical, that is ugly, that is showing something that we should be ashamed of, which is exactly the reason why the artist taken up this subject.
And how did it get its name?
It's a long story that maybe we can wait for the exhibition.
Well, this is one of the reasons why it was called a Fire Mountain, because 10 years ago the main source of income for homeless people was mining copper. Mining meaning collecting or stealing cables and burning the plastic that covers the cables on a fire, which produces a lot of smoke, black smoke. And here on the video, you can see how you can get the copper from the cables.
I see. So the junkyards or recycling points wouldn't take copper cable with the plastic casing still on.
Exactly.
And people came to this spot because they could burn it without
being noticed, or it would take police or firemen to get there long enough so they can finish their job. You cannot really do it in the center of the city.
Okay, so we're looking at quite a selection of cables, various sizes, as well as keys and locks and nuts and bolts, household goods.
And it's all placed in a big museum case and it is a reminiscent of some archaeological exposition or artifacts from some foreign exotic culture. But in fact, they were all collected in Prague. So it is a little bit misleading, or it was an intention of an artist to put it into this museological connections. And in fact, if we look at some of the artifacts shown, these are the pieces of copper, how they are being sold to recycling places. And it truly looks like some archaeological artifact, something that we can encounter in a historical museum. Some of them are connected with sources of income, but there are also objects that are connected with personal lives, everyday life of homeless people in Prague.
Mm-hmm. There are maybe half a dozen stuffed animals and other toys, half of a dollhouse. Were there children living there?
No, but toys or stuffed animals are very visible. If you visit a homeless colony or homeless shelters, there are always some stuffed animals or toys, and they are owned by adult people, but it shows maybe their dreams or traumas and need for having a home, having a friend. So, for example, these two bottles that we can see here from washing machine liquid, detergent. So the one on the right is a makeshift washing machine. You put a dirty underwear inside, put a little bit of soap in there, shake it, then you get a clean underwear. Mm. And the one on the left, it's a makeshift toilet. When it's too cold outside to go out from your tent, you can use the bottle. But something I have to say is that the whole exhibition was prepared in a collaboration with homeless people. They were invited for the opening, so the artist was not trying to exploit them without them knowing what is going on. And he not only collected different objects and materials, but also collected their stories, their histories, that are in a quite extensive way present here at the exhibition as well.
Also part of the Fire Mountain exhibition is a model of the development project that has emerged in the Prague neighborhood of Třebešin by the disused freight train station that the homeless community was built up around. Exhibition curator Tomáš Pospíšil says there are plans to install, at least temporarily, a stone monument on the site made by one community member, into which he chiseled a simple statement of their existence.
It was actually done by one of the homeless men, because he used to be, he was working with stone. The artist took the homeless person to the quarry, they picked a stone, they took the stone to Prague, put it to a place where the homeless people from the Fire Mountain live now. And so it's a giant piece of stone, and it's written there, Fire Mountain. We've been here, we lived here, but we are not here anymore. Goodbye.
And that report was by Brian Kennedy. I'm afraid that's all we have time for in today's programme. Please send any comments you may have to english@radio.cz. And you will, of course, find us on Twitter, on Facebook and on Instagram. But for now, from me, Ian Willoughby, and everybody here at Radio Prague, thank you for listening, folks, and speak to you soon.